You're listening to Monocle on Saturday, first broadcast on the 30th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello there from me, Emma Nelson, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday, and coming up on today's programme, I'm delighted to say Isabel Hilton, founder of China Dialogue, is joining me in the studio to go through the week's news. Very good morning to you, Isabel. What have you spotted?
Oh, lots of things. It's been a rich week for stories. I'm fascinated by the rise and rise of Truth Social on the stock exchange. China and New Zealand and the United States with the UK are trading accusations of cyber espionage. Lots of things to talk about.
Looking forward to it. Then,
there needs to be challenge. You know, there needs to be a stage where people can be involved and proactively be part of the community or proactively contribute to the future of the town.
We head to Hong Kong, where Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson sits down with the leading developer and hotelier Yuta Oka at Monocle's The Chiefs Conference. Plus, Monocle's Maylie Evans hears from the ceramicist Robert Herman at his latest exhibition in London called From California with Love. Live from London, this is Monocle on Saturday. And a very warm welcome if you've just switched on your radio. Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are. Hello, Isabel Hilton. How is life in the Hilton world?
Oh, life's pretty busy, actually. I've been pinging around giving talks and writing things and doing the usual stuff that I do.
And you've just been sent a very large consignment of books, which you have to read. Tell us what you can about that.
Well, as the world will soon know, I'm involved in judging a major prize this year. And, of course, I'm looking forward to it with great excitement, but also a little bit of dread, because that is an awful lot of reading.
Well, indeed. How many books do you know you're going to get to read?
It's several hundred, actually. But, well, the advice is you know quite soon whether it's worth continuing. Actually, I probably shouldn't say that. But if by chapter one you're not convinced, and all the books are read by at least two judges. So if you're wrong about that, your fellow judge might say, no, hang on a minute, chapter four is brilliant. But on the whole, you sort of know. I did know someone who used to review new fiction, who gave the first page his undivided attention. And after that, if it didn't work, it didn't work.
I wonder whether that's how we all are now. I mean, I often ask the question, how many of us read past the first three lines or first three paragraphs of a news article online? We don't anymore.
Oh, no, well, online we tend not to, that's true. In fact, I think we're all losing concentration, aren't we?
I was going to ask you, how are you, in this age where we are going, where we are swiping, dare I say, how do you muster the huge question, how do you muster the concentration to read several hundred books?
I think I became very aware of how much my concentration had gone when about 5 years ago I sailed the Atlantic on quite a small boat, and there was no signal, so the electronics were just off the agenda, and I read as I used to read, and it really came back to me that things had changed. That when I, you know, and before the age of the phone and the tablet, that's how we used to read, and it was such a joy, actually. But it's quite hard to reconstruct in the distracted world that we actually live in.
I was about to say, it's quite an
maybe I'll just get in a boat with a lot of books.
That's quite an big boat. Don't sink. It's quite an extreme way of going about things to work out. To read the way you... I mean, not entirely
that wasn't
sure.
Actually why I was in the Atlantic, but it was a very beneficial side effect.
And how do you read in the way that we used to read? I think I understand what you mean, but I'd be grateful for you to sort of paint a picture as to how it feels and how your brain settles.
I think we have to, if we're doing it on land without the extreme measure of actually sailing the Atlantic, I think put all the electronics in another room, you know, let there be no radio, let there be nothing but you and the book. And if you can create those conditions and settle into it, and perhaps start with, you know, like detoxing, start with an hour a day and see how it goes. If you can do that, I think it might come back.
I think even 10 minutes a day might be how we are now. I will ask you, what were you doing sailing the Atlantic in a very small boat?
It was somebody, I met a man at a party, as you do, and he was looking for crew. And I thought, well, if I don't do this, I'll always wonder what it was like. I'd always regret it. It's not often that you get asked to help crew a boat across the Atlantic.
And how
there were only four of us.
I was about to say, is that why you read so many books, whether you got on with them or not?
Well, it is quite a confined space. And actually, afterwards, I realised it had all been a bit of a gamble. But they were very nice. And actually, there isn't a lot to do if the weather's okay. And we did it the easy way from the Canaries to Tobago. So essentially you're on a reach most of the time. So there isn't a lot of stuff to do. You have to do the watch for, 8 hours at night. Apart from that, you can read and it's lovely. There's nothing to watch. There are no birds in the middle of the Atlantic, at least not many.
I was about to say, what does that do for your mind? I mean, goodness knows the number of pieces of fiction and indeed fact that have been written about that absolute sense of isolation when there is no contact with anything else that has a pulse, from below in the unfathomable deep. What does that do to a mind?
One thing it does is that it gives you a powerful sense of geography, that you think of all the people who have sailed the Atlantic and what it must have felt like for the first people who did it. We know famously they were afraid of falling off the edge of the world. And they were doing it under conditions which were considerably more extreme than the ones that I was in. And the time it takes, and it gives you a sense, it was rather like travelling on the Trans-Siberian Express as opposed to flying, which I've also done. So if you fly from Hong Kong to London, it's, 9 hours in a plane and then you're somewhere completely different. Whereas if you go by land, across China and across Russia and then Poland and, you just have a completely different sense of how communities relate to each other, how geography determines history. And sailing the Atlantic was much the same, that sense that nothing came easily, that these were, and people lived their lives on the ocean. And, I know it all sounds rather banal, we know that, but actually to do it gives you a far stronger sense of it.
Yeah, the banality is quite interesting when you're on an aeroplane. I remember, not long ago, following the map. We are now flying over that bit.
Yes.
And, you're flying over Erbil.
Yes.
And you think, and then you fly over India, and you think, obviously it was quite a long flight, and you look down and you think, if we landed now, that little glass of wine that I'm sort of sipping in my seat would seem like a rather strange affair. When you actually get the reality of what's going on down there, it seems all peaceful and distant. I've never quite got over that, actually.
I've also done it the other way. That I remember when I covered the first election in Haiti after the fall of Baby Doc, and it descended into the most appalling chaos, mayhem, bloodshed, and leaving Haiti. A few days after the election, the chaos was still pretty rampant. It's a 90-minute flight to Miami Airport, where it's entirely peaceful, people eating ice creams, people in shorts going about their business. And that's a reverse shock, actually. It's so extremely close, but it's a completely different world.
Is that strange thing where they close the cabin doors and it's wheels up? And that's it, no connection to the world anymore, apart from seeing it as a geographical sort of, I don't know, an amusement when you look down. It's quite strange. Right, OK, we digress from the papers. What have you found in the papers today, Isabel?
Well, I've been following, I've been following this week's excitements over trading accusations of espionage. The Brits and the Americans and New Zealand have accused China in some detail of engaging in cyber espionage. No surprise there, you might think, but it's quite unusual for them to be quite so explicit, because although we know that China does do a lot of electronic spying and a lot of exfiltration of industrial secrets and all that kind of thing, this was an attribution for two things. One, in the UK case, the in the penetration of the Electoral Commission, and that's the body that oversees British elections, which we knew had happened but hadn't been attributed to China until this week. And the other was a whole series of about 20 MPs who are noted for their strong positions on China, who had been harassed, shall we say, online. So, you know, the kind of things that are pretty tiresome, that emails were sent in their name, which they hadn't sent, and, you know, all kinds of things had gone on, cyber harassment. And again, China was explicitly named for that. And a unit in China, which is well known for cyber harassment and espionage, was named, and a number of individuals associated that were sanctioned. Now, meanwhile, in China, China's complaining about penetration of its systems by the Brits and the Americans, not to be outdone. And also in Hong Kong, you know, there's been a tightening of the national security law. And an ever broader definition of what security is. So it now covers the economy, social development, you know, almost anything that you might wish to write about as a journalist, or indeed you might wish to know about if you were doing due diligence for investors.
The interesting thing in this case is the different way that different governments have responded to this. I mean, you mentioned the fact the US and the UK was a big story here in London last Monday when it was revealed, you know, all these false emails being sent. And it's tiresome. It could actually be more than tiresome. It sort of takes up an awful lot of energy and intellectual space, doesn't it? And time to try and fix the messes.
Absolutely.
That are created. But there's an article in the Associated Press talking about how New Zealand's National Cybersecurity Centre noticed stuff and said that New Zealand is not going to follow the US and UK in sanctioning China simply because it doesn't have a law to do it. I mean, you sort of get the idea that New Zealand is perhaps a little slow off the mark here, but also whether they consider it a major problem or not. Should they?
I think they should, because actually New Zealand has been targeted in the past. In particular, individuals have been targeted. There's an academic called Anne-Marie Brady, about 10 years ago, had a really serious bout of harassment from the Chinese government over her academic work. So, you know, it's not that this has never happened in New Zealand. The strongest reaction, as you might expect, was from the United States. They've actually issued arrest warrants for individuals, you know, which goes beyond sanctions. Chances of ever arresting them are very slim, but sentiments in the United States against China are, you know, pretty high across the divide. Britain has had a mixed response, to be honest. And you might think that over Hong Kong, Britain has not responded quite as strongly as it might, considering it's a treaty partner. But also there's an issue that I've been looking at recently, which is the imminent arrival of a large number of Chinese electric vehicles. Electric vehicles, you know, are very good for the climate, and we need to decarbonize our transport sector. But the problem is they're also computers on wheels, and they are collecting and transmitting information all the time. They're receiving instructions all the time because they have to. You have to upgrade the software and all of that. Now, that's okay if these vehicles are produced in a friendly power. But if we no longer think that China is a friendly power and China is producing really good electric vehicles, 10,000 euros cheaper than anybody else, then essentially we are admitting onto our roads a whole collection of manipulable machinery that could be used to create tensions, to degrade the electricity grid, to block the cities in the event of a crisis. All sorts of possibilities are open. And if you drive a Tesla in China, you're not allowed to drive near a military base. If you drive a Tesla in China, you're not allowed to drive around a city that Xi Jinping is visiting because, of course, the Chinese authorities understand perfectly well what an intelligent car can do in terms of data collection, in terms of disruption, in terms of anything you really want it to do.
This is that sort of end point of globalization that people have been talking about recently, isn't it?
It is, because, you know, we build up these intricate economic and industrial relationships on a basis of trust. And unfortunately, that trust really, as far as China goes, that strategic trust has gone. Mm. I mean, I don't know if you remember in the glory days of the golden era, proclaimed by then Prime Minister Cameron, the proposition was put that China should be able to build and operate nuclear power plants in Britain, which was to make a 50-year bet that nothing could possibly go wrong between our two governments, or indeed between China and our closest ally, the United States. That never seemed like a very sensible bet, to be honest. And, of course, it's now been rescinded. But there are versions of that right through our economy, right through our industrial supply chains, particularly in the field of renewable technologies, of solar panels, wind turbines, batteries and electric vehicles, which China has invested in heavily, produces very efficiently and cheaply, and we need. And it is a dilemma that we haven't quite faced up to.
I do love it when you come into the studio. You'll scare the pants off us. It's absolutely wonderful. We just think, don't step outside.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter, everybody. Don't get in that car. Don't pick up that phone. If you do pick up that phone, are we going to be picking up Trump Social?
Personally, I think I have better uses for my money. I don't know if you're on Trump's mailing list, but it is
social, just
kind of overwhelming. I don't know how I got on it, but I get all these emails saying, dear friend.
You're part of the gang.
I'm part of the gang.
Oh,
it's
brilliant.
Basically, dear friend, send more money now. I mean, that you know, there are variations on this, but that's pretty much what you get.
What's it like to be part of Truth Social? Do you feel?
Oh, I'm not on Truth Social.
Oh, that's a shame.
I'm just on the mailing list. No, God,
okay.
No, I would not. I think I'd spared myself Truth Social. In fact, I have that in common with a lot of people because Truth Social actually has an estimated 5 million users last month, compared with more than 3 billion on Facebook, 2 billion on TikTok. If you were betting on social media, you, from a rational perspective, you wouldn't buy shares in Truth Social. But the people who are buying shares in Truth Social and who have created a kind of paper wealth for Trump of several billion dollars, which he rather needs at the moment but can't actually access, but they're not buying, they're not investing for financial reasons. They're investing for ideological reasons, because, you know, they're part of that gang and they're quite prepared to put their money in. I think they may think they're going to make a profit, and I fear they're going to be rather disappointed. I don't think anyone is going to get very much financially out of Truth Social.
Indeed, one wonders whether what your strategy is if you were to chuck a couple of thousand or hundred or whatever, how many dollars you have in your back pocket to chuck at Truth Social, whether you do it just to get an easy hit or you just think, hang on, this is a banker, it'll be here in 10 years' time. I doubt very much that's what, you know, am I being slightly cynical there by suggesting that perhaps this may not be the stayer?
It may not be. And I think that probably quite a few people made a quick profit on the first day. But I think if you look at who's investing, they are described as retail investors, which means regular people. If you think that 70 million people voted for Trump in the last presidential elections, that argues that they're people who believe almost anything, because, you know, his penchant for truth is a challengeable proposition. They believe him, they believe in him, and they're prepared to support him in order, you know, to fight off the persecution that he says he's suffering. That persecution, which is Trump speak for all the legal cases that he's facing, he has spent, since leaving office, $100 million on legal expenses. And that was money that had been left over from his presidential campaign, largely. And so he's a bit strapped for cash right now. And there's an awful lot more coming up, as we know. He's got to find actually rather less money than he did. It's about $300 million at the moment for one of the cases in New York, which has come down by a couple of hundred million. But still, he's got to find it. And nobody will, I mean, no rational financial institution will lend him the money. Nobody will subscribe to the bond. So this was the last ditch to try to create a sense of a man with solid financial resources. He can't sell his share in Truth Social for a year, I think it is. So it's not going to solve his immediate problem, but I suppose it does create an impression of wealth, which was beginning to look a little questionable, and that might encourage others to put money in. Personally, I doubt it. I'm on the advice of my broker, I'm not going to invest in Truth Social.
Other shares are available.
Indeed.
Stay with us, Isabel, because I want us to head to Hong Kong now, where the Monocle team hosted the Chiefs Conference on Thursday. It was an event featuring top CEOs and founders from across the region sharing their lessons on building better business. One of the speakers was Yuta Oka, a leading developer and hotelier who's collaborated with the hospitality legend Adrian Zecca there to transform a 140-year-old home in the Japanese island town of Sotoda into a modern ryokan, and is working hard with locals to revive communities that suffered with the effects of depopulation in the past. Well, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson sat down with Yuta at the conference and began by asking how the project began on this very small island.
I have the luxury to work with a few luxury hotel brands, not large scale, but small scale, very culturally sensitive brands that kind of lift up the local community and the culture and the arts and food and everything. Frankly, what Monocle does as well. And the highest impact that had in my life was my stay at Amandari, which was also a creation of Adrian Zecca. And when I stayed there, a gentleman got me at the airport. He was explaining about Amandari on my way to Ubud as his home, as his village, not as a luxury hotel that people pay $2,000 per night for. So he was like, my village is like this, my neighbor is like this. And then I get to the hotel and the receptionist was his mother. And then the mother tells me that her father works in the kitchen. So I was like, what am I doing? Where am I staying? I just met three generations of a family who takes pride in their village. And the hotel is almost exactly mocking kind of the aesthetics of the village. And they all take pride in Amman and also the village that they grew up in. And I was like, why can't this happen in Japan, where I grew up, or where I love, and where my roots are from, and basically revitalize some of the beautiful neighborhoods that I love in Japan that are suffering from depopulation and less energy every year?
The community, I was also curious, you know, islands can be quite particular places. Did they welcome you with open arms?
They initially didn't. We started the project by building Azumi, renovating the old 140-year-old house previously owned by a salt merchant, which was the most grand real estate on the island. And they were very dubious, and some people were against it. And for us, it was a very explorative pursuit. So it also took time for us to raise money and to go through the development process. And we used that time to do workshops with the local community. And that went on for 2 years before we broke ground. Because we took that time, we found out that the locals actually really don't care about the ryokan, because it's a place to welcome others. So they were like, if you can really pull it together, go ahead. But, you know, we're not going to be able to stay there. It's expensive, right? And like those small conversations led us to really think, is this really going to lead to my experience of that three generation of family in Ubud telling me about how they take pride in their local community? And the answer was obviously no. So we kept on talking. And after a year and a half of discussion of, okay, what kind of town you want to take this to when you ask the locals? And there were like many answers, but at the end of the day, after a year and a half, the answer was, we want to live here. We want people to live here. We actually don't want a boom and bust of a tourist destination. We want whoever comes here, we want them to think that this is a livable place and somewhere that they want to keep on coming back and take the time, a big chunk of their time in life, and love the place.
I mean, and you've achieved something that the Japanese government hasn't been able to, which is repopulation. I mean, you're actually bringing people into the island, aren't you? You're people working for you. Is it a struggle to hold them there, though? Do they leave or do they want to stay?
Actually, I wanted to point out that one of my colleagues over there Ryota. He was the brave gentleman who moved to this island 4 years ago when nothing, literally nothing, was there. Without him, we would not have been able to have this conversation with the locals. But there needs to be challenge. You know, there needs to be a stage where people can be involved and proactively be part of the community or proactively contribute to the future of the town. And to many developers do wrong, I think, are they decide everything from scratch. But because we were small and limited, we had to start small. We had to have one guy move there, mingle with locals, but that was the best part of what we did. So as long as we keep that, I think there will be more and more people coming.
And that was the hotelier Yuta Oka talking to Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson at the Chiefs Conference in Hong Kong. Listening to that was Isabel Hilton. Isabel, I was torn but quite delighted by this idea of a man, Yuta Oka, who specialises in creating effectively quite nomadic lifestyles. That whole post-COVID working from anywhere, digital nomad, I hate that expression, but it kind of works for this purpose. But also at the same time, the idea of creating a community. It seems at the start quite counterintuitive, but somehow we seem to make sound as if it works really well.
And I think it's a very appealing idea. And it's not, you know, it's not just Hong Kong. Actually, a thing that people perhaps don't quite appreciate about a great deal of Asia, so Taiwan, Japan, Hong Kong, we think of one main island, but all of these are archipelagos. And in Lantau, for example, in Hong Kong, was a delightful island with no cars. And, you know, that right next to this extraordinary metropolis of Hong Kong, which is one of the most modern cities in the world. But I think all over the world, there is a sort of nostalgia for the peace of rural communities and the question of how to get people to live in them and sustain livelihoods, because their economic existence really doesn't make sense anymore. Those villages exist for a pretty kind of low-level agricultural income, and that doesn't work. So if you want to recreate communities, there does need to be an option, and now we have an option. If you have an internet connection, you can work anywhere. And the idea of reviving traditional communities with younger people, with families, so the school doesn't have to close, you know, so that there is a future, is immensely appealing.
It's an interesting idea as well. When you talk about a wider family unit there, when you listen to what we've heard about just then from Yuta Oka, that you get very much the sense that this is for people in very small groups or indeed single people, individuals who think, actually, I'm going to live in Tokyo for a few days a week, and then when the tiny, tiny apartment I live and work in drives me bananas, I can now go out
to
the island and to do this and to do that. There's that sense that actually there might be a sort of a two-tier sense of community here, that you'll get people who are effectively stuck because there's more than one of them, and then those who can just jump in and out of whichever kind of environment they choose.
Possibly, but if you were to reverse that pattern and say, I'm going to live on the island with my family and my children will go to the school on the island, and then when I need to, I will go into the city, which might be 1 or 2 days a week, then you have a very different feel in the rural community and a very different sensibility for the nomad.
You were, when we mentioned the fact that the Chiefs was held in Hong Kong. Don't worry if you have missed the Chiefs. We have tons of events like this at monocle.com/events. Go and have a look. There's always something. The Quality of Life Conference will be coming up a little bit later this year. But you, as an expert on China, you raised your eyebrows a little bit there. I mean, there is, and I think we discussed this quite a lot before the Chiefs started, you have a dual narrative, don't you? You have a space, a city, which is currently being gripped more tightly by Beijing every day, every week. There is always a new development which makes you think, gosh, this is going to be harder to move, this is going to be harder to speak, this is going to be, if you're an international company, it might become very, very difficult to do business there. Yet at the same time, you have this fabulously connected, efficient, brilliant city, which is irresistible as well to work in. It still pulls, it still excites. I mean, enough for, you know, Monocle to have the Chiefs Conference there, bringing in people from all over the region as well, from Singapore, from Japan. there is this dreadful paradox that Hong Kong now proposes, isn't there?
There is, and I think it'll take quite a long time for Hong Kong to lose its appeal, but I think it is going down. I think it, and actually there's been a sort of slight sense of panic in mainland China about the drop in investment, in foreign direct investment. So people, it's not so much that people are pulling out wholesale, but from the mainland, but there's very, very little new investment going in. And you can see the concern at the higher levels of leadership. Xi Jinping, you know, made a big point of meeting a delegation of American businessmen last week and saying, no, it's lovely, come in, the water's really nice. But there is, nevertheless, the concerns that about the security laws, which I mentioned. In Hong Kong, you know, there was an arrest of a citizen who was accused of working for MI6, the British spy agency, under the guise of a consultancy, a business consultancy. You don't need many cases like that, given the erosion of rule of law in Hong Kong, for that kind of consultancy to think, you know what, I think I'll go to Taipei or Singapore. If you look at certain sectors in Hong Kong, so civil society, it was a fantastic place to run an NGO because you were close to China, you had information flow, you had people coming through, but you had legal guarantees and, you know, legal rights. Those have pretty much moved now. They've gone elsewhere. Things, obviously, in the media, you've got Apple Daily, Jimmy Lai is on trial, Apple Daily is closed, Hong Kong Free Press has moved. You know, there's just an exodus of that sort of sector. And it remains to be seen how much concern business will have about a further tightening of the security law, which happened just last week. 2 weeks ago, which broadens the definition of national security to include, you know, economy and social stuff. Very hard to operate without worrying about that. And I think that although people will always want to come to Hong Kong for events, I think if I were running that sort of business, I would find Singapore rather more congenial at this point.
Thank you for that, Isabel. Finally, on today's programme, we visit the Carpenters Workshop Gallery here in London for their exhibition From California with Love. It celebrates the ceramicist and painter Robert Herman. And Monocle's Maylee Evans caught up with the artist at the exhibition to find out more.
And so if you're in your studio, mm-hmm. do you have any parameters or structure to when you sit down and decide to make a new piece? Like, are you thinking, okay, this is maybe the kind of glazes I might work with today, or is it very organic, very much of that day, of that moment, let's see what happens today?
Well, sometimes I have these glazes ready. Like this one was typical where I thought, I never have used this kind of lilac, and I thought it's probably going to be really hideous, and it's kind of hideous, but I kind of thought, wow, it worked, so I leave it. There are gestures in there that are repetitive, like I feel like a house painter in some of them. Same with the paintings. It's not expressionistic for me. It's more detached. They're not emotional. I have so many glazes, and I don't do glaze charts. People have this yellow and that yellow, and then you have green and 20 different greens. I would go crazy. I cannot make my decision. So instead of trying to make a decision, I just do it. I was telling somebody how I built a house once. I had collected, before I even had land or money to build a house, I had collected windows and doors. I said, that's going to go over my house. So when I built the house, we used those to build the house. So it's sometimes this is indirect how this happens.
And talk to me about California, because you've lived there for some time now. Yeah. How do you think it shows up in your work?
I don't know if it influenced me or not. I've been there for 40 years. I don't think I have a localized aesthetic of that. There are artists in California that, like Peter Vulkus, who I was influenced by, but more by the intensity or freedom than by the work itself. He was more related to Picasso and things.
I wondered if we could take a look at some of the mezcal cups, the little ones.
Yeah.
Is it right if we just have a little look around there?
They're like tests. This is basically better than the big ones, because you make one, and then you glaze it, and then you dip it, and it's done. It's kind of my mind. Like somebody bought a piece and then it got destroyed.
Or
it
was,
can you do that again? I mean, it would be great, but I can't. And then, I don't know. And these were basically mezcal cups. I use them at home for espresso. This is actually what really interested me in ceramic, this kind of texture, sometimes the silliness. Like here, I had a little nipple in there. I'm bored, so I do them. I can make one every 2 minutes. Throw it, you just make it. Some are, they're all on the wheel, but it's so... Like,
it feels like so much of your work is about play and experimentation, yeah, yeah, and it's very much not about needing a certain outcome. It's more about the process.
Some of them look funny, looks like a chicken. This is all leftovers. You just put it together. Oops. It's like clay that drops off when you do the cut on the bottom.
For you, this is what you want to continue in. It's experimentation. What are you excited by at the moment?
I am like a child. I said, wow, look, mommy, I did this. Like, I just did a poop. No, like you get excited. It's not pride, it's just I enjoy making it. I really feel, wow, I did that. You get excited about these little... And I personally like these maybe more than the big ones. Initially, I made these really for fun. But normally, I just made them to give them to friends. And made them for myself for tests, but then I made them to have my cup. And then I said, oh, I love this. Can I have one? Yeah, take five. You know, it was like that. I think I always fell into something. And I think it's much harder for younger people now. I mean, sounds paternalist. And I saw it with my students. First of all, it's more expensive to have a studio. But also, a lot of the new students, it's nearly like a profession. When I studied, there was no hope anyways that you would ever make any money. So I painted houses. But now they come in and they already have a portfolio. They have already a gallery sometimes. And you would be in the studio. And I said, this painting, I would not do this. I would, oh, it's already sold. It's very difficult. I was lucky, maybe, let's put it this way. I found something where I can just, it's magic to me. I look at it and say, whew, can't believe it.
And that was Roger Herman in conversation with Maylee Evans there. The exhibition From California with Love is on at Carpenter's Workshop Gallery in London until Friday, the 26th of April. You have a month, ladies and gentlemen. And that's all the time that we have for today's edition of Monocle on Saturday. The warmest of thanks to my guest, Isabel Hilton. And thanks to our producer and studio engineer, Mariella Bevan. Monocle on Saturday is back next weekend. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, hope you can join me for Monocle on Sunday tomorrow. Until then, have a great weekend. Bye-bye.